can wait their own self till after the tempest.
We went up to our hill. Now I knew why he had chosen the highest point of land on the quay for our hut. Even so, I thought, the waves might tumble over it. The first thing Timothy did was to lash our water keg high on a palm trunk. Next, he took the remaining rope that we had and tied it securely around the same sturdy tree.
In case the tempest reached this high, lock your arms over the rope and hang on, Philip.
I realized then why he had used our rope sparingly, why he had made my guideline down to East Beach from vines instead of rope. Every day I learned of something new that Timothy had done so we could survive. During the afternoon, he told me this was a freak storm, because most did not come until September or October, August sometimes, seldom in July.
But this year the sea be angry with all the death upon it. De war.
The storms bred, Timothy said, in the eastern North Atlantic, south of the Cape Verde Islands, in the fall, but sometimes when they were freaks, and early, they bred much closer in a triangle way off the northeast tip of South America. Once in a great while, in June or July, they sometimes made up not far from Providencia and San Andres. Near us. The June ones were only pesky, but the July ones were dangerous.
"These be a western storm, I be guessing. They outrageous strong when they come," he said.
Even Stew Cat was nervous. He was around my legs whenever I moved. I asked Timothy what we should do to protect him. He laughed.
"Stew Cat be go up de palm on de lee side if it be getting too terrible. Don't worry about Stew Cat."
Yet I could not help worrying. The thought of losing either of them was unbearable. If something bad happened on the quay, I wanted it to happen to all of us. Nothing changed during the afternoon, although it seemed to get even hotter. Timothy spent a lot of time down at the raft, stripping off everything usable and carrying it back up the hill. He said we might never see it again, or else it might wash up the hill so that it would be impossible to launch. Timothy was not purposely trying to frighten me about the violence of the storm. He was just being honest. He had good reason to be frightened himself.
"In 28 I be on de Hetty Red, so to Antigua when the tempest hit. De wind was outrageous and de old schooner break up like chips fallen for the axe. I wash ashore from de sea so while no man believe it. No other man from de Hetty Red live cept in me."
I knew that wild sea from long ago was much on Timothy's mind all afternoon. We had a huge meal late in the day, much bigger than usual because Timothy said we might not be able to eat for several days. We had fish and coconut meat, and we each drank several cups of coconut milk. Timothy said that the fish might not return to the reef for at least a week. He'd noticed that they'd already gone to deep water. After we ate, Timothy carefully cleaned his knife and put it into the tin box, which he lashed high on the same tree that held our water keg.
"We're ready, Philippe," he said.
Chapter 15. At sunset, with the air heavy and hot, Timothy described the sky to me. He said it was flaming red and that there were thin veils of high clouds. It was so still over our quay that we could hear nothing but the rustling of the lizards. Just before dark, Timothy said,
"'Twon't be long now, Philippe.'
We felt a light breeze that began to ripple the smooth sea. Timothy said he saw an arc of very black clouds to the west. They looked as though they were beginning to join the higher clouds. I gathered Stew Cat close to me as we waited, feeling the warm breeze against my face. Now and then there were gusts of wind that rattled the palm fronds, shaking the little hut. It was well after dark when the first drops of rain spattered the hut, and with them the wind turned cool. When it gusted, the rain hit the hut like handfuls of gravel. Then the wind began to blow steadily, and Timothy went out of the hut to look up at the sky. He shouted,
"'Dey boilin' over now, Philippe! 'Tis hurricane, to be sure!'
We could hear the surf beginning to crash as the wind drove waves before it, and Timothy ducked back inside to stand in the opening of the hut, his big body stretched so that he could hang onto the overhead frame, keeping the hut erect as long as possible. I felt movement around my legs and feet. Things were slithering. I screamed to Timothy, who shouted back,
Be nothing but the little lizard coming high ground.
Rain was now slashing into the hut, and the wind was reaching a steady howl. The crash of the surf sounded closer. I wondered if it was already beginning to push up toward our hill. The rain was icy, and I was wet head to foot. I was shivering, but more from the thought of the sea rolling over us than from the sudden cold. In a moment there was a splintering sound, and Timothy dropped down beside me, covering my body with his. Our hut had blown away. He shouted, "Philippe! Put your head down!" I rolled over on my stomach, my cheek against the wet sand. Stewcat burrowed down between us. There was no sound now except the roar of the storm. Even the sound of the wind was being beaten down by the wildness of the sea. The rain was hitting my back like thousands of hard berries blown from air guns. Once something solid hit us, and then rolled on.
"Sea grape!"
Timothy shouted. It was being torn up by the roots. We stayed flat on the ground for almost 2 hours, taking the storm's punishment, barely able to breathe in the driving rain. Then Timothy shouted hoarsely,
"To the palm!"
The sea was beginning to reach for our hilltop, climbing the 40 feet with raging whitecaps. Timothy dragged me toward the palm. I held Stewcat against my chest. Standing with his back to the storm, Timothy put my arms through the loops of rope and then roped himself, behind me, to the tree. Soon I felt water around my ankles. Then it washed to my knees. It would go back and then crash against us again. Timothy was taking the full blows of the storm, sheltering me with his body. When the water receded, it would tug at us, and Timothy's strength would fight against it. I could feel the steel in his arms as the water tried to suck us away. Even in front of him, crushed against the trunk of the palm, I could feel the rain, which was now jabbing into me like the punches of a nail. It was not falling toward earth, but being driven straight ahead by the wind. We must have been against the palm for almost an hour when suddenly the wind died down and the rain became gentle. Timothy panted.
"Di ai! We can relax a bit till the other side of the tempest hit us."
I remembered that hurricanes, which are great circling storms, have a calm eye in the center.
"Are you all right?" I asked.
He replied hoarsely,
"I be damp, but all right."
Yet I heard him making small noises, as if it were painful to move, as we stood back from the palm trunk. We sat down on the ground beside it, still being pelted with rain, to wait for the eye to pass. Water several inches deep swirled around us, but was not tugging at us. It was strange and eerie in the eye of the hurricane. I knew we were surrounded on all sides by violent winds, but the little Kay was calm and quiet. I reached over for Timothy. He was cradling his head in his arms, still making those small noises like a hurt animal. In 20 or 30 minutes the wind picked up sharply, and Timothy said that we must stand against the palm again. Almost within seconds the full fury of the storm hit the Kay once more. Timothy pressed me tightly against the rough bark. It was even worse this time, but I do not remember everything that happened. We had been there a while when a wave that must have reached halfway up the palms crashed against us. The water went way over my head. I choked and struggled. Then another giant wave struck us. I lost consciousness then. Timothy did too, I think. When I came to, the wind had died down, coming at us only in gusts. The water was still washing around our ankles, but seemed to be going back into the sea now. Timothy was still behind me, but he felt cold and limp. He was sagging, his head down on my shoulder.
"Timothy, wake up,"
I said. He did not answer. Using my shoulders, I tried to shake him, but the massive body did not move. I stood very still to see if he was breathing. I could feel his stomach moving, and I reached over my shoulder to his mouth. There was air coming out. I knew that he was not dead. However, Stewcat was gone. I worked for a few minutes to release my arms from the loops of rope around the palm trunk, and then slid out from under Timothy's body. He slumped lifelessly against the palm. I felt along the ropes that bound his forearms to the trunk until I found the knots. With his weight against them, it was hard to pull them loose. Even though they were sailor's knots and had loops in them, the rope was soaked, which made it worse. I must have worked for half an hour before I had him free from the trunk. He fell backwards into the wet sand and lay there moaning. I knew there was very little I could do for him except to sit by him in the light rain, holding his hand. In my world of darkness, I had learned that holding a hand could be like medicine. After a long while, he seemed to recover. His first words, painful and dragged out, were,
"Philippe, you all right? Be true."
"I'm okay, Timothy," I said. He said weakly,
"Terrible tempest."
He must have rolled over on his stomach in the sand, because his hand left mine abruptly. Then he went to sleep, I guess. I touched his back. It felt warm and sticky. I ran my hand lightly down it, suddenly realizing that I, too, was completely naked. The wind and sea had torn our tatters of clothes from us. Timothy had been cut to ribbons by the wind, which drove the rain and tiny grains of sand before it. It had flayed his back and his legs until there were very few places that weren't cut. He was bleeding, but there was nothing I could do to stop it. I found his hard, horny hand again, wrapped mine around it, and lay down beside him. I went to sleep, too. Sometime long after dawn, I awakened. The rain had stopped, and the wind had died down to its usual whisper. But I think the clouds were still covering the sky because I could not feel the sun. I said, "Timothy," but he did not answer me. His hand was cold and stiff in mine. Old Timothy, of Charlotte Amalie, was dead. I stayed there beside him for a long time, very tired, thinking that he should have taken me with him wherever he had gone. I did not cry then. There are times when you are beyond tears. I went back to sleep, and this time when I awakened, I heard a meow. Then I cried for a long time, holding Stewcat tight. Aside from him, I was blind and alone on a forgotten quay.
Chapter 16. In the afternoon, I groped west along the hill. 30 or 40 feet from the last palm tree, I began to dig a grave for Timothy. I cleared palm fronds, chunks of sea grape, pieces of wood, dead fish, fan coral, and shells that the sea had thrown up. I marked out a space about 7 feet long and 4 feet wide. Then I dug with my hands. At first, I was angry with Timothy. I said to Stewcat, "Why did he leave us alone here?" Then as I dug, I had other thoughts. With his great back to the storm, taking its full punishment, he had made it possible for me to live. When my grandfather died, my father had said, "Philip, sometimes people die from just being very, very tired." I think that is what happened to Timothy. I also think that had I been able to see, I might not have been able to accept it all. But strangely, the darkness separated me from everything. It was as if my blindness were protecting me from fear. I buried Timothy, placing stones at the head of the grave to mark it. I didn't know what to say over the grave. I said, "Thank you, Timothy," and then turned my face to the sky. I said, "Take care of him, God. He was good to me." There didn't seem to be anything else to say, so I just stood by his grave for a while. Then I felt my way back to the spot where our hut had been. I located wood and piled it around the base of the palm tree that held our water keg and the tin box. Both were to the lee side of the storm. It took me a long time to get the keg and the tin box to the ground, but I found, on opening the bung, that the water was still sweet and that the matches, wrapped in cellophane inside the tin box, were dry. But the two small bars of chocolate that we had been saving for a feast were ruined. I had no taste for them anyway. Feeling it everywhere under my feet, I knew that the quay was littered with debris. I started cleaning the camp area, or what was left of it. I piled all the palm fronds, frayed by the wind, in one place, sticks of wet driftwood in another. With Stewcat constantly around, I stumbled over him several times.
I worked until I felt it was nearing darkness. I found one lone coconut in a mass of sea grape and broken sticks. I opened it and ate the meat, offering to share with Stew Cat, who didn't seem interested. Then I made a bed of palm fronds and sprawled out on it, listening to the still angry sea as it tumbled around the damp quay and thinking, I must feed myself and Stew Cat. I must rebuild the hut and build another signal fire down on East Beach. Then I must spend each day listening for the sound of aircraft. I knew Timothy had already given up on any schooner entering the dangerous Devil's Mouth. I was certain that the sea had washed away Timothy's markers atop the coral reef, and I was also sure that my guide vine rope leading down to the beach had been snapped and tangled by the storm. But now, for the first time, I fully understood why Timothy had so carefully trained me to move around the island and the reef. The reef, I thought. How could I fish without any poles? They must have been washed away. Then I remembered Timothy saying that he would put them in a safe place. The trouble was he'd forgotten to tell me where. I got up and began to run my hands over each palm trunk. On one of them I touched rope. I followed it around to the lee side with my fingers. And there they were. Not two or three, but at least a dozen, lashed together, each with a barbed hook and bolt sinker. They were one more part of the legacy Timothy had left me. The sun came out strong in the morning. I could feel it on my face. It began to dry the island, and toward noon, I heard the first cry of a bird. They were returning. By now I had taught myself to tell time, very roughly, simply by turning my head toward the direct warmth of the sun. If the angle was almost overhead, I knew it was around noon. If it was low, then of course it was early morning or late evening. There was so much to do that I hardly knew where to start. Get a campfire going, pile new wood for a signal fire, make another rain catchment for the water keg, weave a mat of palm fibers to sleep on, then make a shelter of some kind, fish the hole on the reef, inspect the palm trees to see if any coconuts were left, I didn't think any could be up there, and search the whole island to discover what the storm had deposited. It was enough work for weeks, and I said to Stew Cat, I don't know how we'll get it all done. But something told me I must stay very busy and not think about myself. I accomplished a lot in 3 days, even putting a new edge on Timothy's knife by honing it on coral. I jabbed it into the palm nearest my new shelter, so I would always know where it was if I needed it. Without Timothy's eyes, I was finding that in my world, everything had to be very precise, an exact place for everything. On the 5th day after the storm, I began to scour the island to find out what had been cast up. It was exciting, and I knew it would take days or weeks to accomplish. I had made another cane, and beginning with East Beach, I felt my way back and forth, reaching down to touch everything that my cane struck, sometimes having to spend a long time trying to decide what it was that I held in my hands. I found several large cans and used one of them to start the time can again, dropping 5 pebbles into it so that the reckoning would begin again from the night of the storm. I discovered an old broom and a small wooden crate that would make a nice stool. I found a piece of canvas and tried to think of ways to make pants from it, but I had no needle or thread. Other than that, I found many shells, some bodies of dead birds, pieces of cork, and chunks of sponge, but nothing I could really put to good use. It was on the 6th day after the storm when I was exploring on South Beach that I heard the birds. Stew Cat was with me, as usual, and he growled when they first screeched. Their cries were angry, and I guessed that 7 or 8 might be in the air. I stood listening to them, wondering what they were. Then I felt a beat of wing pass my face, and an angry cry as the bird dived at me. I lashed out at it with my cane, wondering why they were attacking me. Another dived down, screaming at me, and his bill nipped the side of my head. For a moment I was confused, not knowing whether to run for cover under sea grape, or what was left of it, or try to fight them off with my cane. There seemed to be a lot of birds. Then one pecked my forehead sharply, near my eyes, and I felt blood run down my face. I started to walk back toward camp, but had taken no more than 3 or 4 steps when I tripped over a log. I fell into the sand, and at the same time felt a sharp pain in the back of my head. I heard a raging screech as the bird soared up again, and another bird dived at me. I heard Stewcat snarling and felt him leap up on my back, his claws digging into my flesh. There was another wild screech, and Stewcat left my back, leaping into the air. His snarls and the wounded screams of the bird filled the stillness over the quay. I could hear them battling in the sand. Then I heard the death caw of the bird. I lay still for a moment. Finally, I crawled to where Stewcat had his victim. I touched him. His body was rigid, and his hair was still on edge. He was growling, low and muted. Then I touched the bird. It had sounded large, but it was actually rather small. I felt the beak. It was very sharp. Slowly, Stewcat began to relax. Wondering what had caused the birds to attack me, I felt around in the sand. Soon my hand touched a warm shell. I couldn't blame the birds very much. I'd accidentally walked into their new nesting ground. They were fighting for survival after the storm, just as I was. I left Stewcat to his unexpected meal and made my way slowly back to camp.
Chapter 17 10 pebbles had gone into my time can when I decided to do something Timothy had told me never to do. I was tired of eating fish and sea grape leaves, and I wanted to save the few green coconuts I'd managed to find on the ground. There were none left in the trees. I wanted scallops or a langosta to roast over the fire. I didn't dare go out off North Beach for scallops because of the sharks. But I thought there might be a langosta clinging to the coral at the bottom of the fishing hole. From what Timothy had told me, the sea entrance to the hole was too narrow for a large fish, a shark, to swim through. Barracuda, he'd said, could go through, but they were not usually dangerous. If there happened to be an octopus down there, it would have to be a very small one. The big ones were always in deep water. So he'd said it was safe for him to dive in the hole. I sharpened a stick the way Timothy had done, but I knew that if I felt a langosta with my left hand, I would have to be very quick with my right hand, or he would use his tail to push away from me across the sand. With Stewcat, I went down to the reef and felt my way along it until I found the familiar edges of the hole. I told Stewcat, "If I'm not out in 20 minutes, you better jump in and get me." The crazy cat rubbed along my leg and purred. Holding the sharpened stick in my right hand, I slipped into the warm water, treading for a moment, waiting to see if anything came up. Then I ducked my head underwater, swam down a few feet, and came up again. I was certain that nothing was in the hole aside from the usual small fish I yanked out each morning. After a few minutes, I had my courage up and dived to the bottom, holding the sharp stick in my left hand now and using my right hand to feel the coral and rocks. Coming up now and then for air, I slowly felt my way around the bottom of the small pool, touching sea fans that waved back and forth, feeling the organ pipe coral and the bigger chunks of brain coral. Several times I was startled when seaweed or sea fans would brush against my face and swam quickly to the surface. It must have taken me nearly 30 minutes to decide that I could hunt langosta in the hole. This time, I dived in earnest. I went straight down, touched the bottom, and then took a few strokes toward the coral sides of the pool. Timothy had said that langosta were always on the bottom, usually over against the rocks and coral. To my amazement, I touched one on the first sweep and drove the sharp stick into him, swimming quickly to the surface. Panting, I shouted to Stewcat, "Lobster tonight!" I swam to the edge, pushed the langosta off the stick, caught my breath again, and dived. I dived many times without again touching the hard shell that meant langosta. I began sticking my hands deeper into the shelves and over the ledges near the bottom. I rested a few minutes, then decided I'd make one more dive. I was happy with the lobster that was now on the reef, but it was quite small, barely a meal for Stewcat and myself. I dived again, and this time found what seemed to be an opening into a deep hole, or at least the hole went far back. "There has to be a big lobster in there," I thought. Up I came again, filled my lungs, and dived immediately. I ran my hand back into the hole, and something grabbed it. Terrified, I put my feet against the rocks to pull away. The pain was severe,
Whatever had my wrist had the strength of Timothy's arms. I jerked hard, and whatever it was came out with my arm, its tail smashing against my chest. I kicked and rose to the surface, the thing still on my wrist, its teeth sunk in deep. I'm sure I screamed as I broke water, flailing toward the edge of the hole. Then the thing let loose, and I made it up over the side and out of the hole. Pain shooting up my entire arm, I lay panting on the edge of the pool and gingerly began to feel my wrist. It was bleeding, but not badly, but the teeth had sunk in deep. It wasn't a fish, because the body felt long and narrow. Sometime later, I made an informed guess that it had been a large moray eel. Whatever it was, I never got back into the hole again. Chapter 18. There was no day or night that passed when I didn't listen for sounds from the sky. Both my sense of touch and my sense of hearing were beginning to make up for my lack of sight. I separated the sounds, and each became different. I grew to know the different cries of the birds that flew by the quay, even though I had no idea what any of them were. I made up my own names for them according to the sound of their cries. Only the occasional bleat of the gull gave me a picture of that bird, for I had heard and seen them many times around the seawall in Willemstad. I knew how the breeze sounded when it crossed the sea grape. It fluttered the small leaves. When it went through the palm fronds, the storm hadn't ripped away. It made a flapping noise. I knew the rustle of the lizards. Some were still on the island after the storm. I could only guess they'd somehow climbed high into the palms. Otherwise, how could they have lived with water lapping over the entire quay? I even knew when Stewcat was approaching me. His soft paws on a dried leaf made only a tiny crackle, but I heard it. One mid-morning in early August, I was on the hill near the camp when I heard the far-off drone of an airplane. It was upwind from me, but the sound was very clear. I reached down to feel Stewcat. He had heard it too. His body was tense, his head pointed toward the sound. I dropped to my knees by the fire, feeling around the edges until I grasped the end of a stick. I drew it back. Timothy had taught me to lay the fire sticks like a wheel so that the fire burned slowly in the center, but always had a few unburned ends on the outside. I tended the fire a half dozen times each day. I spit on the stick until I heard a sizzle. Then I knew there was enough fire or charring on it to light off the base of dried palm fronds beneath the signal fire. I listened again for the drone. Yes, it was still there. Closer now. I ran down the hill straight to the signal fire, felt around the palm fronds, and then pushed the stick over them. I blew on it until I heard the crackle of flames. In a few minutes, the signal fire was roaring, and I ran to South Beach where I would be able to hear the aircraft without hearing the crackling fire. Standing on South Beach, I listened. The plane was coming closer. I yelled toward the sky, "Here! Down here!" I decided to run back to East Beach to stand near the fire and the new arrangement of rocks that spelled out, "Help." Thinking any moment the plane would dive and I would hear the roar of its engines across the quay at low altitude, I stood with Stewcat a few feet from the sloshing surf. I waited and waited, but there was no thundering sound from the sky. I could hear nothing but the crackling of the fire, the washing sound of the surf. I ran back to South Beach, where I stood very still and listened. The plane had gone. Slowly, I returned to East Beach and sat down in sea grape shade. I put my head down on my arms and sobbed, feeling no shame for what I was doing. There seemed to be no hope of ever leaving the quay, yet I knew I could not always live this way. One day I would become ill, or another storm would rage against the island. I could never survive alone. There had been many bad and lonely days and nights, but none as bad as this. Stewcat came up, purring, rubbing along my legs. I held him a long time, wondering why the aircraft had not come down when the pilots saw the smoke. At last, I thought, perhaps they didn't see the smoke. I knew it was going up into the sky, but was it white smoke that might be lost in the blue-white sky? Or was it dark and oily smoke that would make a smudge against the blueness? There was no way to tell. If only there were some oily boards.
the kind that drifted around the waters of the Shattagat. But I knew that the wood floating up on the beach consisted mostly of branches or stumps that had been in the water for weeks or months. There was nothing in them to make dark smoke. I began to think of all the things on the island. Green palm fronds might send off dark smoke, but until they were dried, they were too tough to tear off the trees. The vines on North Beach might make dark smoke, but the leaves on them were very small. The sea grape! I snapped some off, feeling it between my fingers. Yes, there was oil in it. I got up and went over to the fire, tossing a piece in. In a moment I heard it popping the way hot grease pops when it is dropped into water. I knew how to do it now. The smoke would rise from the quay in a fat black column to lead the planes up the Devil's Mouth. If I heard another aircraft, I'd start a fire and then throw bundles of sea grape into it until I was certain a strong signal was going up from the island. Timothy hadn't thought about black smoke, I was sure. That was it. Feeling better now, I walked back up the hill to gather the few palm fronds that were left for a new fire base. I woke up at dawn on the morning of August 20th, 1942, to hear thunder, and wondered when the first drops of rain would spatter on the roof of the shelter. I heard Stewcat, down near my feet, let off a low growl. I said, "It's only thunder, Stewcat. We need the water." But as I continued to listen, it did not seem to be thunder. It was a heavy sound, hard and sharp, not rolling. More like an explosion, or a series of explosions. It felt as if the quay were shaking. I got up from the mat, moving out from under the shelter. The air did not feel like rain. It was dry, and there was no heavy heat. "They're explosions, Stu," I said. "Very near us." "Maybe destroyers," I thought. I could not hear any aircraft engines. Maybe destroyers fighting it out with enemy submarines. And those heavy, hard, sharp sounds could be the depth charges that my father said were used by the Navy to sink U-boats. This time, I didn't bother to take a piece of firewood down to East Beach. I dug into the tin box for the cellophane-wrapped package of big wooden matches. Four were left. I ran down the hill. At the signal fire, I searched around for a rock. Finding one, I knelt down by the fire and struck a match against it. Nothing happened. I felt the head of the match. The sulfur had rubbed off. I struck another. It made a small popping noise and then went out. I had two more matches left, and for a moment I didn't know whether to use them or run back up the hill to the campfire. I stopped to listen, feeling sweat trickle down my face. The explosions were still thundering across the sea. Then I heard the drone of an aircraft. I took a deep breath and struck the next-to-last match. I heard it flare and ran my left hand over the top of it. There was heat. It was burning. I reached deep into the fire pile, holding the match there until it began to burn the tips of my fingers. The fire caught, and in a moment was roaring. I ran across the beach to begin pulling sea grape down. I carried the first bundle to the fire and threw it in. Soon, I could smell it burning. It began to pop and crackle as the flames got to the natural oils in the branches. By the time I had carried 10 or 15 bundles of sea grape to the fire, tumbling them in, I was sure that a column of black smoke was rising into the sky over the quay. Suddenly, a deafening roar swept overhead. I knew it was an aircraft crossing the quay not much higher than the palms. I could feel the wind from it. Forgetting for a moment, I yelled, "Timothy! They've come!" The aircraft seemed to be making a sharp turn. It roared across the quay again, seeming even lower this time because the rush of wind from it was hot. I could smell exhaust fumes. I yelled, "Down here! Down here!" and waved my arms. The plane made another tight circle, coming back almost directly over me. Its engine was screaming. I shouted at Stewcat, "We'll be rescued!" But I think that he'd gone to hide in the sea grape. This time, however, the aircraft did not circle back. It did not make another low pass over the island. I heard the sound going away. Soon, it had vanished completely. Then I realized that the explosions had stopped, too. A familiar silence settled over the quay.
All the strength went out of my body. It was the first real chance of rescue, and maybe there would not be another. The pilot had flown away, perhaps thinking I was just another native fisherman, waving at an aircraft. I knew that the color of my skin was very dark now. Worse, I knew that the smoke might have blotted out the lines of rocks that spelled help. Feeling very ill, I climbed the slope again, throwing myself down on the mat in the hut. I didn't cry. There was no use in doing that. I wanted to die. After a while, I looked over toward Timothy's grave. I said, "Why didn't you take us with you?" Chapter 19. It was about noon when I heard the bell. It sounded like bells I'd heard in St. Anna Bay and in the Chateauguay. Small boats and tugs use them to tell the engineer to go slow or fast or put the engines in reverse. For a moment, I thought I was dreaming. Then I heard the bell again, and with it, the slow chugging of an engine, and voices. They were coming from East Beach. I ran down there. Yes, a small boat had come into the Devil's Mouth and was approaching our quay. I yelled, "I'm here! I'm here!" There was a shout from across the water, a man's voice. "We see you!" I stood there on East Beach, Stew Cat by my feet, looking in the direction of the sounds. I heard the bell again, then the engine went into reverse, the propeller thrashing. Someone yelled, "Jump, Scotty! The water's shallow!" The voice was American, I was certain. The engine was now idling, and someone was coming toward me. I could hear him padding across the sand. I said, "Hello!" There was no answer from the man. I suppose he was just staring at me. Then he yelled to someone on the boat, "My Lord, it's a naked boy and a cat!" The person on the boat yelled, "Anyone else?" I called out, "No, just us." I began to move toward the man on the beach. He gasped, "Are you blind?" I said, "Yes, sir." In a funny voice, he asked, "Are you all right?" "I'm fine now. You're here," I said. He said, "Here, boy, I'll help you." I said, "If you'll carry Stew Cat, you can just lead me to the boat." After I had climbed aboard, I remembered Timothy's knife stuck in the palm tree. It was the only thing I wanted off the quay. The sailor who had carried Stew Cat went up the hill to get it while the other sailor asked me questions. When the first sailor came back from the hill, he said, "You wouldn't believe what's up there." I guess he was talking about our hut and the rain catchment. He should have seen the ones Timothy built. I don't remember everything that happened in the next few hours, but very soon I was helped up the gangway of a destroyer. On deck I was asked so many questions all at once that one man barked, "Stop badgering him! Give him food, medical care, and get him into a bunk!" A voice answered meekly, "Yes, sir, Cap'n." Down in sick bay, the captain asked, "What's your name, son?" "Philip Enright. My father lives in Willemstad. He works for Royal Dutch Shell," I answered. The captain told someone to get a priority radio message off to the naval commander at Willemstad, and then asked, "How did you get on that little island?" "Timothy and I drifted onto it after the Hato was sunk." "Where's Timothy?" he asked. I told the captain about Timothy and what had happened to us. I'm not sure the captain believed any of it because he said quietly, "Son, get some sleep. The Hato was sunk way back in April." I said, "Yes, sir, that's right." And then a doctor came in to check me over. That night, after the ship had been in communication with Willemstad, the captain visited me again to tell me that his destroyer had been hunting a German submarine when the plane had spotted my black smoke and radioed back to the ship. There was still disbelief in his voice when he said he'd checked all the charts and publications on the bridge. Our quay was so small that the charts wouldn't even dignify it with a name. But Timothy had been right. It was tucked back up in the Devil's Mouth. The next morning, we docked at the naval base in Cristobal, Panama, and I was rushed to a hospital, although I really didn't think it was necessary. I was strong and healthy, the doctor on the destroyer had said. My mother and father flew over from Willemstad in a special plane. It was minutes before they could say anything. They just held me, and I knew my mother was crying. She kept saying, "Philip, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry." The Navy had notified them that I was blind so that it would not be a shock, and I knew I looked different. They'd brought in a barber to cut my hair, which had grown quite long. We talked for a long time, stew cat on my bed, and I tried to tell them all about Timothy and the K, but it was very difficult. They listened, of course, but I had the feeling that neither of them really understood what had happened on our K. 4 months later, in a hospital in New York, after many x-rays and tests, I had the first of three operations. The piece of timber that had hit me the night the Hato went down had damaged some nerves. But after the third operation, when the bandages came off, I could see again. I would always have to wear glasses, but I could see. That was the important thing. In early April, I returned to Willemstad with my mother, and we took up life where it had been left off the previous April. After I'd been officially reported lost at sea, she'd gone back to Curaçao to be with my father. She had changed in many ways. She had no thoughts of leaving the islands now. I saw Henrik van Boven occasionally, but it wasn't the same as when we'd played the Dutch or the British. He seemed very young. So I spent a lot of time along St. Anna Bay and at the Ruiterkade market, talking to the black people. I liked the sound of their voices. Some of them had known old Timothy from Charlotte Amalie. I felt close to them. At war's end, we moved away from Charlu and Curaçao. My father's work was finished. Since then, I've spent many hours looking at charts of the Caribbean. I've found Roncador, Rosalind, Quito Sueño, and Serenilla Banks. I've found Beacon Cay and North Cay, and the islands of Providencia and San Andres. I've also found the Devil's Mouth. Someday, I'll charter a schooner out of Panama and explore the Devil's Mouth. I hope to find the lonely little island where Timothy is buried. Maybe I won't know it by sight, but when I go ashore and close my eyes, I'll know this was our own Cay. I'll walk along East Beach and out to the reef. I'll go up the hill to the row of palm trees and stand by his grave. I'll say, "This be that outrageous Cay, eh, Timothy?"
Author Theodore Taylor talks about what inspired him to write The Cay.
I was researching an adult book called Fire on the Beaches. I was down in the basement of Coast Guard headquarters in Washington, D.C. Fire on the Beaches was a story of German submarine warfare up and down the east coast of the USA, down into the Gulf of Mexico, and then in the Caribbean Sea. And one morning I came across three paragraphs in a report that had been written by the master of a Dutch ship called the Hato. The report talked about the torpedoing, where it was, where it occurred, off the coast of Colombia. And then there was a twist in it that just jumped out at me. An 11-year-old boy had been on the stern of that ship that evening. The sun had gone down, and it was in a period of light known as submarine light, where you can't see the submarine because of the grayness. The submarine's painted gray, and you just can't see it unless you get very close to it. This kid was back on the stern after having had his dinner, and all of a sudden the torpedo hit, blowing that ship almost half in two. A raft was launched automatically by the impact of the torpedo. The kid jumped overboard, swam up to the raft, climbed up on it. In the meantime, from the midship section of that sinking ship, a lifeboat had been launched. And into that lifeboat crawled the passengers that had survived and a couple of three of the seamen. Now the sun had gone down already. And someone spotted that kid on the raft, But before they could do anything about it, before they could launch something to go to the kid, the German submarine surfaced nearby, blocking out the sight of the boy on the raft from those in the lifeboat. The submarine captain interviewed the captain of the Hato, talked to him about where that ship had come from, where it was going, what kind of cargo it had on board, how many passengers. And then the sub, having completed its mission, got underway. By this time, it was black night. All night long, the people in that lifeboat rowed in ever-widening circles, shouting, shooting up flares, hoping that they would attract the little boy. At first light in the morning, they looked out across the face of the sea, and he was gone. And he has been gone to this very day. How he died, no one will ever know. He could have slipped over the side of that slippery raft top, gotten into the water, sharks got him. Something happened to him. There was a tin box underneath the raft, out of the water, but in the surface of it. In that tin box was some food, first aid kit, flares that he could have shot up. I'm sure that he didn't even know what was there, and therefore he couldn't use any of that stuff to attract attention. Now, I thought about that happening for 11 years. I knew there was a story there. I knew there was probably a very good story. But I wasn't ready to do it. I was doing other books in the meantime. And finally, after that time period, from the time that I found the story until I sat down here in Laguna Beach and wrote the K. It literally wrote itself. I was simply tapping on the typewriter every day. 3 weeks was all it took.
Why did you call it the K?
The K is a Spanish word that dates back to the 14th century, and it means waterless island. A very few of those Ks down there have palm trees on them. Mostly they don't. And I knew where it was, 600 miles off the east coast of Nicaragua. I had sailed by it, and it seemed to me to be the perfect setting for the story. It was in the right position for that raft to drift to after the torpedoing, and it met all the qualifications that I wanted for it to meet. And fictionally, I planted 5 palm trees on it because of scenes that required palm trees.
Were the characters in The K based on people you knew?
I had lived in the Caribbean for 3 years. And I had met Timothy, whose real name was Robert, R-O-B-B-E-R-T. That's the only name he had. He was born on St. Croix, and I met him in St. Thomas. We began a friendship. He was then, I think, about 70 years old, and had been a sailor all of his life until he retired. He'd sailed on those wonderful, wonderful schooners down there, and he knew more about the Caribbean Sea than any man I'd ever run into. And I had sailed on several merchant ships where there were West Indian sailors aboard. But Robert knew more about that sea than any man I'd ever met. So I picked him to be the rescuer of that 11-year-old boy. Now, that 11-year-old boy was Dutch. I don't speak Dutch. I don't understand it. So I went back into my own childhood from about the age of 5 until I was 10 in Statesville, North Carolina. I had a playmate who was a nice kid in all ways except one. And in that one way, he was tragic. His mother had taught him to hate black people, and he hated them with a passion. It's very seldom that you'll ever find a kid 5 to 10 years old who has that kind of hang-up. But I thought, gee, I might be able to change him by putting him on that raft alone with a very old black man, who would be Robert.
How did you know so much about surviving on a desert island?
I'm a sailor, and I've been around water pretty much all my life, and there are certain things that if I was stranded on an island like that, I would take advantage of what is on that island and what is on the sea, the lobster, the langusta, and I think I would survive. I've been in one, let me see, I was in a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico, I was in a hurricane in the Caribbean Sea, I was in a hurricane in Virginia, and one someplace else.
How did you know how to write Timothy's accent so well?
I learned it from the real Robert. I fished with him, and I listened to him. He was a great talker. And I listened to him, not knowing at that time that I'd ever use him as a fictional character. But I learned the Creole Calypso dialect from him, because that's the way he talked. The other thing is, the way he looked was the way he was. The way he walked. His personality was pleasing. He had a good laugh. I simply plucked him out of real life and put him down on paper, which is one reason that book wrote in 3 weeks. Usually, after I've done research, it may take me a year or a year and a half.
Why did you decide to make Philip blind?
The blind part, I didn't really think about it. It just one morning when I was trying to get a mental picture of this whole book, how it would start, what would be the middle and what would be the end. And I decided one way that I might change that kid would be to blind him so that when he first sees Timothy on the raft, he sees an old black man with a face that showed all of his age, and then the blindness comes on after, I think, about 3 days or 4 days, something like that. And his memory of this face and this huge black man did things to his mind, and he recalled how many times his mother had said that they were, you know, black people were trash. But I felt that that was the way, that was the theme of the book and how I should really do it. There's one line in that book that I think sums it all up, and that's after they had become friends. And at the end of a very nice day in the evening, Philip says to old Timothy, "Are you still black?" In a nutshell, that is the book. The little boy has changed, the two are friendly. And Timothy then goes about knowing he's old, you know, he's over 70. The real Timothy, Robert, did not know how old he was. He had one name, and that was Robert. He did not know his parents. He was raised by an aunt. This is the real guy I'm talking about. And at that point of the story, Timothy begins to realize that nobody, perhaps, will rescue them. They don't know they're on this tiny little island. So he goes about teaching Philip how to survive on that little island. And he does a great number of things, all of which point to his own death.
What impact has the K had on your life?
A great impact. It's in 17 different editions, and I've really tried to figure out how these different countries, Sweden and Denmark and France and Italy and you name them, even there's a Russian edition and there is a Japanese edition and there's a Chinese edition. How in the world do they handle the Creole Calypso dialect? I have no idea. I just have no idea. I haven't done it recently because I had five bypasses about 2 years ago. But I used to visit schools all over the country and some all over the world. And it was a great thing for me personally to meet the students, and meet the teachers. I have an autobiography that's coming out. My mailing list is about 1,400, and I am giving that story of my life to those 1,400 teachers and librarians as a Christmas gift. The autobiography is book 58, but I've written two beyond that, and it's just been a wonderful career, particularly dealing with children, correspondence, and I couldn't have asked for, in a lifetime, I couldn't have asked for anything more. During the school year, I get up to 500 letters a week from schools scattered throughout the country and overseas. Now, these are handwritten letters from students. I get them in packets of 30 to 40 letters sent by the teacher. And some of these teachers have been sending me letters for 25 years. And if you read these letters, you sense immediately, number one, their affection for old Timothy. Number two, his teaching them, teaching the boy how to survive. And number three, it's definite. They also understand why the book was written, and they understand that the racism message was and is directed to them. Those letters are great to read. They really are. Some talk about Stu Cat. Now, Stu Cat was a cat on board the Hato. I heard about him from a person on that voyage. And I could not bear to leave that blind child alone on that island without some kind of, you know, an animal or birds have cold eyes. And I didn't want to use a bird. I mean, you know, let's say a parrot. But the cat fit in perfectly. So I used the cat as a character. I will tell you one thing about the K. I was speaking to an audience over in Santa Ana about writing about books, the K and the bomb and other books. And I got through my speech and went out in the hallway to go somewhere else. And a woman walked up to me and gave me her name, I forget it, and said, do you know what you did? And I thought, my God, what else have I done now? What terrible thing have I done? And she said, you created the first blind child hero. Now, the book is in Braille in almost 20 countries. Philip stayed on that tiny, tiny K for 4 months after the death of Timothy. And she said that blind children reading it think, if he can do that, and I get into some kind of terrible trouble like we was in, maybe I'll survive too. I had no idea. I just had no idea that I'd done that. So that's the single best reward I've ever had, to think of the blind kids in Braille reading the book.
This is Michael Boatman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The K, by Theodore Taylor. This program was produced and directed by Charles Potter, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 1969 by Theodore Taylor. Production copyright 2005, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.